In the 1960s, they decided to, when I say they, I mean the authorities and the planners, and incidentally with the backing of the Catholic Church, they decided to wipe out this community. So the Catholic Church wasn't always on the side of the native people. And they built what became called the Divis Flats, because it was in the Falls Road in Belfast, which was a strong nationalist road. When I say nationalist, I mean Republican, whereas the other road next to it is the Shankill Road, which is very much pro-British. And they produced the Divis Flats. Typical 1960s architecture, seven blocks and a tower, six stories high with, up in the air streets, all the stuff that they were building in other parts of Britain and that. And next slide, please. It was the same mistake that was made so often in many other places. The people at first thought, well, yes, we'll have them, because at least they would have indoor toilets, and things like that, comforts. But it didn't take them long to realize that these things don't work. These architectural ideas don't work, of streets in the sky and things like that, because it doesn't coalesce with the old community culture. And also the Divis Flats were interesting because even before they were finished, they were very much in the middle of a war, because in the late 60s, the people in the north of Ireland rose up against injustices. Like, for instance, in the 1970s, I was teaching students from Belfast who were 22 but had no vote. They were supposed to be British, but they had no vote because they didn't own a house or a property or anything. And that's interesting, because you think by then everybody should have a vote. And it followed from the 1968, revolts all over the world, but it became the Irish one. And near the Divis Flats, which by this time the people didn't like, because they could see that, they had all the usual faults that you get from these architectural schemes. You had condensation, you had vermin, you had asbestos was being used everywhere, which is a very dangerous material. And not far away, there was a few streets, particularly a street called Bombay Street, which was a street that divided the Catholic and therefore nationalist community and the Protestant, therefore unionist, British community. And the whole of Bombay Street was burnt out. And the people, which was a nationalist street, Catholic street, they fled into the unfinished flats. So from the beginning, these flats had bullet holes all over them. Next slide, please. And the people have decided to call it No Place for a Dog. And almost from the very beginning, they wanted the flats demolished. Now, the next few photographs are not of Belfast. I don't have protest photographs of Belfast. These are from Derry, which is Northern Ireland's second city. But it's pretty much the same in both cities. So this was a civil rights march. There were lots of civil rights marches. Okay, this is how they were met. Next slide. That's how they were met. These are what you... No, leave that on. Leave that other one on. These are what you call the B specials. They don't exist anymore, but part of the police force of the north of Ireland, which is still British. And they were sectarian police. They were all from one side of the political spectrum. They were able to keep their weapons at home. And they were brutes, actually, the specials. Next slide, please. And the The uprising began. It wasn't anything new in Ireland. Ireland was full of uprisings over many centuries. Okay, next slide. Next slide. I find this very, very interesting, you know, because there's a man with a catapult who's trying to stop a tank. I only showed you those slides, which are by, incidentally, by a man called Clive Lipkin from his book, The Battle of the Bogside. So he's allowed me to use these photographs. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so there's the flats. Not all of them, of course. And it wasn't long before they became known and accepted throughout Europe as the worst housing in Western Europe. There was bad housing in Britain and France and everywhere, but somehow this was worse than any of them. It was big. The tower block had a British helicopter pad on top, so there were searchlights all the time. The women used to put blankets over the balconies of the streets in the sky because there's cameras everywhere, and even their privacy was being invaded. The place was always full of soldiers coming in and policemen coming in. Next slide, please. These are those stupid streets in the sky. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. You know, that's just a small detail, but it's interesting. The nature of the city at the time, thank God it's a lot more peaceful now, a hell of a lot more peaceful. But it wasn't so long ago when it was a war zone, like Beirut. This is just a pedestrian bridge. Now, no people from the Divis Flats would cross that bridge after 6 o'clock at night, because just a quarter of a mile away was a loyalist street, you know, and there'd be shots fired, you know, and you might get killed. Next slide, please. You know, I mean, you talk about design and form, well, I don't know what you think, but next slide, please. Next slide, please. Keep that slide on for a while. The people tried to retain, you know, they did the murals of their old community, the old Poundlony. The other thing was that Divis Flats had achieved its own sort of fame, as well as being known as the worst housing in Europe. It was also used as a backcloth for TV dramas, you know, because it's a bit like, what's that film, I don't know, Bleak Streets, you know, and things like that. It was a very useful backcloth for a very hard city and frightened city. Next slide, please. And that's another project of mine, which I'll tell whoever's interested in the next few days the stories of that band, but it has no slides. It's just an interesting project I was involved in for 3 years. With myself and a friend, we traveled Britain in that van. It was called the Mobile Planning Aid Unit, where we gave planning aid for free to people who couldn't afford to pay for it. A bit like legal aid. And, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières. I traveled Britain for 3 years in that, literally doing our work on the streets and in the car parks and on the promenades and whatever. We just, instead of sitting in schools and universities, we just went out with a place in which we could sleep and cook and eat and then turn into an office. And to put a long story short, we eventually decided to bring it to Ireland. And we arrived in these flats, which for the first time I'd ever seen them. And I met a man you might have heard of called Gerry Adams, who's the president of Sinn Féin, which is the Republican Party in Ireland. And he showed me the flats. I met him because I'd been asked by a Dutch magazine called Plan to interview him on communities and planning. And those were very dangerous times. It wasn't the sort of situation where you could just ring him up and say, I'll see you in your office at 4 o'clock, you know. His voice was banned. Even though now he meets statesmen and queens and kings all over the world. It's the same, like Mandela and all things like that. One day you're a terrorist, the next day you're a statesman. And the people of Divis Flats had been fighting for 14 years as a residence association, the DRA, the Divis Residence Association, to get these flats demolished. But they were having a very difficult time persuading the powers to demolish the flats, and the powers were the British government, the Northern Ireland planning government, and things like that. Whereas in other parts of Britain, they were demolishing flats that had proved a failure, that had proved an architectural and planning failure. But for some reason, they wanted to keep the Divis flats. Or, as they said, repair them, you know, renovate them. The people would have none of that. And they did things like they had strikes, rent and rate strikes. And they were kind of punished all the time. Like, by now, 33 members of this community have been shot dead. And they were finding it very difficult. And why were they finding it difficult? I think it's because the British, because it was a very Republican, nationalist housing estate, you know, often occupied by, first of all, a party called the Irish Republican Socialist Party, which was an armed group, and it got the nickname the Planet of the Earps. And then it was just a general Republican, you know, it was a place where the fighters came from. And so it suited the British to sort of keep them together rather than have them in a more civilized community that you could move about in. It's always good to keep your enemy closed like this. So they asked us to help them. And I said, what the hell can we do? You know, we don't have any money or anything. Well, only a bit of money from our van. And our van, incidentally, the van project, the mobile unit, was funded by 50% by the British government and by the organization for which I was working at the time in London, called the Town and Country Planning Association. A nice liberal organization, you know, but with good history. And our job was to link communities all over Britain. But even though they didn't say it, don't go to Ireland, don't go to Belfast, you see, because Belfast is always special at this time. So I said, what can we do? So we went back to London, shocked by what we'd seen. And we'd seen a lot of bad environments in our life, but we'd never seen anything quite so bad as this. You know, people being poisoned by rats, you know. I mean, the rats in this place were big, very, very big. And, okay, next slide, please. So, there we are, my friend and myself talking. I don't know if you can focus any better, but it doesn't really matter. Talking to some of the people from the flats and that. Okay, next slide, please. Next slide, please. That's just a quick sketch of mine. Like, it was during this project. Very interesting. Imagine 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're in a car with a few people who live in the flats, as I was, and you're suddenly stopped by a crowd of policemen and British soldiers, and stop open the doors, put the lights out, and get out. And so I got out, and I was told by my friends in the car, only give your name and address, you know, you don't have to do anything else but that. So the police got me out of the car, said, who are you? I said, I'm an architect, and I'm working with the residents of the flats. And I remember his words, you know, what sort of a fucking architect are you? He said. And I have this dream, which won't ever come, which might come true one day, but I have this dream that he suddenly looks at me, it's only a dream, and his gun, which is here, you know, goes away, and he looks at me and says, you know, you're right. Because I said to him, what would you do if your mother was being treated in this way, or your father, or your grandmother, you know? I have this dream that he sort of says, yeah, you're right. I never thought of it like that, you know? That. So maybe a message is to get over to your so-called enemy, you know, the ideas. Next slide, please. Anyhow, we went back to London, and those of you who've heard some of my stories before, not all of you will have, I've told you about the organizations that I was involved with, like the ARC, the Architects Revolutionary Council, and even the Schools of Architecture Council, and that. And I sort of got in touch with a lot of these old connections. And it was also the time of the miners' strike in Britain, which was a very big event, the event that in the time of Margaret Thatcher's reign. And it was a very big thing in Britain, the miners' strike. And I suddenly found that people, because I'd written a few articles and got them published and, you know, moved around through newspapers and magazines about these horrible flats. And I suddenly found I was getting responses. You know, like miners who were on strike would send £5. Old age pensioners would send £1, you know, on this. And within about 6 weeks, we found that we'd raised about £6,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And then we realized we could do a really big expose of these horrible flats in Britain. And so we set about it. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. The architectural magazines, you know, backed us. Because it was a bit like Covent Garden. It became not so much a cause celebre, but it was such a... We'd suddenly brought Divers Flats into the limelight. You've got to look at this bloody place. It's so awful, and the people are suffering so much. Next slide, please. The people of Divers were starting their own newspaper along with us. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, Divers says no. The British government and the planning authorities were still insisting that, okay, the flats have problems. They have asbestos, they have vermin, they're not very nice to live in, etc. We'll renovate them, you know, do them up. And the community were adamant that they did not want that. They wanted the bloody things to go. And what they wanted was civilized streets and things. That's an interesting thing. If you want to know about planning and architecture, I'm sure all countries can tell you this, but in the north of Ireland, during the times of what they call the Troubles, the fighting and the conflict, they hardly ever built streets because the planning system was very much influenced by the military. The big architectural concept in Northern Ireland was the cul-de-sac. And the cul-de-sac is easier to control, you see, because all you have to do is put a tank in front of it and a tank behind it, and it's much harder for the people to get out if they're trying to get away. Okay, next slide. So we held this exhibition, and we were able to pay for a professional exhibition maker, and we also had some money to bring the people from Divers over to the exhibition. Well, some of them. Hang on, I should have said something before that. Yeah, A lot of my stories are about tactics. Not every project that I know the sort of things you're interested in, not every project demands the same tactics. Sometimes you can compromise, sometimes you can negotiate, sometimes you can renovate, you know, etc., etc. It all depends on tactics. And we came up suddenly with two brilliant ideas, I think they were, just suddenly into our heads. We said, we'll hold the exhibition where the power is. And the power, whether you like it or not, was in London with the British government. And secondly, we said, we'll hold it in the most luxurious location we can, rather than showing it in, say, a British ghetto or favela. The poor can come, but this is directed at the rich. So we found a location, fortunately, about 5 minutes from Buckingham Palace and 5 minutes from the Houses of Parliament, in a very posh area. And next slide, please. And we only specifically invited the rich, you know, all the lords and ladies and that. I mean, anybody could come, and they did. But we specifically invited all the lords and ladies, all the MPs in the Commons, House of Commons, all the lords in the House of Lords. And a lot of them came. And they were shocked. And so the wives told their husbands, will you, Christ's sake, do something about this awful thing, you know? So these were good tactics. We also got it opened by one of Ireland's most famous actors, a man called Stephen Ray, he opened it, so that helped. Next slide, please. So, and we brought the 16 of the residents over, and, you know, again, on their way over, four of them were arrested and jailed just for being who they were from the flats, you know. So they were released after a few days, but it was that sort of a situation. Next slide, please. But at the same time, and in all our work, we've not only worked out tactics and worked with the people and learned from the people, we've also used our professional talents, you know. You can't criticize something unless you've got an alternative. That's hypocrisy, you know. You've got to have an idea. So one of the things the British were saying was that, oh, we can't demolish the flats because we wouldn't be able to get the same number of people on the site. And we proved them wrong. You know, we proved that you could build streets and you could build spaces. Next slide, please. In phases. So the flats are slowly coming down. Next slide. It's just, I mean, these slides are not of great help to you, but where those horrible flats were, we're now designing streets with shops. And next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. And so, actually, all the flats are gone now. They're gone forever. Gerry Adams, the president of Sinn Féin, who is now a statesman and in the Irish government, said it was the one truly working-class victory in the whole of the Thatcher era. Now, a few things to say about it, and it's over this short story soon, was in many ways, when we worked on projects in other working-class areas, you had to spend some effort, if you like, politicizing the people, just a bit. But of course, you couldn't politicize these people. These people were born politicized because of the nature and the history of Ireland. So it was their victory in the end. They'd been fighting for 14 years. All we did was come along and twist it and sort of just make it happen. Next slide, please. It's not exactly as I would have liked it, but by God, it's better than the flats. Next slide, please. I don't know if any, I've not been to Belfast for a while. Maybe you'd know, Paul, but the tower, is the tower still there? No. The tower was the one thing that they wouldn't get rid of, because the tower had the army post on top, on the helicopter pad. But it might have gone. In the next, but all the rest of it is gone. And that was what people wanted. And that's what anybody who ever saw the community wanted. Next slide, please. And that's the end of the Divis story. What's that story? We couldn't politicize that community. They were already politicized. We couldn't... we knew exactly what everybody wanted. We discovered how to operate in a war zone. Mind you, as in most of the projects I've been involved in, I'm sorry to have to say this, but I lost my job again, you know, because the government took away the funding for the mobile unit, the van, you know, and so. But it's worth it to lose your job. I have another little story. I don't know whether to do it, but again, it's about a tactic. It could be very quick and a very interesting tactic. Let's try it. It won't take a minute. Could you put it on again, and then we'll talk about both. I'll do it very quick. Put the projector on. Next slide. Next slide. Now, okay, this is a place called Bridgetown in England, and it was a former mining village, which turned into an industrial village. Again, a typical working class village and community. Now, it's located on a main road in Britain. It's not a motorway or auto route, but it's one of Britain's main roads, the A3, from the south to the north of England. And so it's in an interesting location. Next slide. It's just a good little community with, you know, its streets and its shops and its pubs and its churches. Next slide. Okay, keep doing. I'm just giving you an impression of the place. There it is. That's the village. Now, this village, small town, really, in all my experience, I've seen planners and authority do bad things, but I've never known outside the history of warfare where an authority plans to exterminate a whole community. They wanted to wipe this whole thing off the map, either to make it into an industrial estate, and some say because they wanted to possibly to be a site for Euro Disney, which ended up in the end outside Paris. I don't know whether that's true, but anyhow, they wanted to wipe it off the map. Okay, next slide, please. There, now, this is the village as it was happening. One of the things I've discovered in quite a few of my projects is that the government and authority talks about terrorism, but there's such a thing as state terrorism, and it can happen in planning situations. And I've seen it happen on several occasions, and this was one. What they do in order to achieve their aims, because they own a lot of the houses, or they bought them, I'm talking about the local authorities, they then send in a bulldozer, and they sort of evacuate the people, knock down a house, or not knock down it, but it becomes vandalized. And in the end, the community loses its spirit, because, you know, vandals come in, squatters come in, you know, rats come in, and things like that. And it doesn't happen always, but it does happen, and it's a tactic that they use. Next slide, please. Next slide. Next slide. No, so this village, which is called Bridgetown, naturally enough, created a residence group, the Bridgetown Residence Action Group, BRAG. That's the natural thing to do if you're threatened with all your community going to be wiped out. But they made a terrible mistake because, and of course, they had 100% support because everybody was threatened, every single person in the whole community. was threatened. But they made a mistake. They wrote beautiful reports to the authorities on why they should not be exterminated. Now, I don't believe in violence or anything like that, but if somebody's going to kill you, you don't write a letter to them arguing why they should not kill you. That's daft, you know. Next slide, please. So they called in our organization called the ARC, the Architects Revolutionary Council. So we went up to the village, and first of all, we told them that. You've made a mistake. You don't theorize about your own extinction. And we called a meeting with them all, and 100% there. And in community struggles, you never get 100%. You know, you're lucky if you get 80% at a meeting and that. But in this one, you got 100% on everything, because everybody was threatened. Everybody was in the same situation. 100% at the meetings. We told them, we did some resistance posters for them. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. There, the planners. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. And so we did all this sort of stuff for posters for their doors and their windows. That was the last slide we did for them. And it was very interesting. This was just an ordinary, peaceful, working-class community, law-abiding and everything. And we asked them, which poster do you like best? And they said, that one. Next slide, please. In all our projects, we started newspapers. This was called The Wild Duck, done by French students of mine. And we got the kids to deliver them. Now, next slide, please. And this was delivered every week. And there again, you see, we'd worked with lots of other communities. This is a piece by a German miner in the Ruhr. We'd worked in the Ruhr with a mining town. And he sort of gave support to this mining town in Britain. Next slide, please. Johnny Toomey from the Covent Garden story I told some of you. You know, he gave his advice. Like, for instance, one of the residents has said, I'll tell you what's a good idea. Why don't I get elected to the council? And then we'll have some power. But that's a load of crap, because Johnny had tried that. If you're a local person in a resistance situation and you join the council, you don't win anything. You just lose everything, because you're always outvoted. So it's a waste of time. And Johnny had found that out by experience and passed it on to the people of Bridgetown. Next slide, please. Next slide. And when also at the same time, I was doing this with my students as well as my Architects Revolutionary Council, but my students. Once again, the students were on these derelict sites that the authorities had created. They were doing ideas, projects, you know, and therefore doing okay in their schools of architecture, making their portfolios and everything. Next slide, please. Next slide. Next slide. This, I'm making this story as short as possible. This was one issue of the newspaper. It was getting publicity because of the tactics. And we wanted the chief planner of the area to say something, but they were too frightened to say it. They didn't want to say something. And we had some American students with us, and we wired them up, and they wrote a letter on a sort of notepaper they'd invented, saying that they were American students on holiday and they were doing a little tour of Europe to find out about the planning system, when in actual fact they were part of a student group and that. And they went to the chief planner, and of course he told them everything, because he thought that they were legit, you know, they were just students from America. And so we were able to publish everything he thought. We were also threatened with a lawsuit because of doing this, but we just ignored it. Okay, a tactic. Next slide, please. Next slide. Now this is, that's why I've done this story very shortly, tactics. Because of all this, this is the only project, and in fact the only village or town in Britain that has ever declared independence. Not independence from the state, but independence from the planners and the architects and their bulldozers. And it worked. This is on the main road. That's the chip shop. And it, the those of you who are Irish will know it comes from the famous sign in the north of Ireland, you are now entering Free Derry. You are now entering Free Bridgetown. And the, you know, the people had a system of sirens and tactics that if a house was going to be demolished one day, they just, and people would occupy it, you know, and things like that. Next slide, please. Next slide. Next slide. These are just some of the things the students did. That's all. I'm just making the point that they were drawing things as well for the people, with the people. So it wasn't all just, you know, fists in the air and everything. Next slide. And it's almost over. Next slide. And we can put the lights on. Next slide. Okay. That's the end of the picture.
What happened to Bridgetown was that...
what we've done is we, there's an old saying in radical action that action comes from reaction. One of the biggest weapons that the establishment, the status quo has, is to simply ignore the situation and ignore you. I.e. you don't get any publicity, they don't answer questions, there's no discussion, just ignore you. That's a very strong tactic. You don't get into the media or anything. So what you've got to do is to provoke them into saying something. And we, of course, had done that when we got the village to declare independence. It just, oh Christ, what's going on, you know? How can this happen? And but in all community situations, communities are just people. And like I told you last week sometime, that even in the birth of Yasa, there was opportunistic little groups who thought we'll use this energy that's been released to create our own little empires. So in Bridgetown, there were a few people. Oh, yeah, we've got all this publicity now. I can get on the council. I can become mayor of the town, etc., etc. And so just a few rumours passed around. This group that are helping us are Trotskyists, you know, whatever, Marxists, which we weren't and everything. And, you know, it wasn't... We'd done our job, so we left rapid years ago. And you just get on with your life and another project. We thought, well, at least we'd help them. And about 20 years later, more than that, 20 years later, the only work I do now is at the School of Public Policy every year for 2 weeks in Birmingham University. And it's very close to this village. And we went on a little trip one day with the students, and we came to Bridgetown, and I'd already told them that story in a lot more detail than I've told you. And I was showing them that wall where you are now entering Free Bridgetown is. And it was still there. And the whole village was still there. And it was still alive. And it hadn't been what they call gentrified or anything. It was still a good, healthy community and village. So I was very pleased. We'd obviously won, you know, in helping them, and they'd won. But I showed the students the wall. Obviously, the sign had gone, although it was still painted blue. But you are now entering Free Bridgetown had gone. And we were just staring at this wall, because the students had seen that slide with the message on. And we're standing staring at a wall. And two women, middle-aged women, came out of the chip shop and thought, this is very odd. It's people just staring at a wall. And they said, who are you doing? Who are you? What are you doing? And I explained to these ladies, whom I didn't know, and said, just briefly told her the story. This is where you used to have the symbol. And their eyes smiled up. They said, we were the 10-year-old children who used to deliver the newspaper, you know, and we hugged each other and everything. So that's the end of those two stories.
you
yesterday when we were going to do this that if there is any clapping or anything, of course, it should be for the organizers of this event, for what they went through last week. I know it's been messy, but by God, they went through a lot, you know. That was a worst case scenario.
So I think a big clap for them would be nice.